Welcome to the podcast of Grace Family Baptist Church, a kingdom-minded, Christ-exalting, multi-generational community of faith. Our current Sunday school series is titled, What Do They Believe? A Study of Cults and World Religions. Let's join Pastor Aaron for this week's Sunday school lesson.
Today we will be studying the religion of Buddhism. It's a very unique religion, and you will find that out as we begin to walk through this. I've used two main books in creating this study, so most of my quotes are coming directly out of here. Even some of my outlines are going to come directly out of these books. The first one is Walter Martin's famous book, The Kingdom of the Cults. We've used that book for many of the lessons that we've written so far. It's not a perfect book, but it is a very thorough book with an incredible amount of information on these different groups. Next book that I used this time was a book called The Compact Guide to World Religions. It's edited by Dean Halverson, and it has a series of essays written on each of these various world religions. And once again, it was just very helpful in creating this lesson. I'm going to start with some quick facts like I normally do out of Walter Martin's book. Some quick facts about Buddhism. Siddhartha Gautama followed the paths of previous Buddhas or enlightened ones until he discovered the middle path. The Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path achieved enlightenment. We're going to unpack some of this as we go on, because I know I'm saying some of this and you're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Other Buddhas, the Eightfold Path, enlightenment. Next, Buddhism shows heavy influence of Brahmism, gods and goddesses in Buddha's history and teachings. Its description of a universal cosmic consciousness is the path of a non-personal essence, sometimes called the void. And this void is probably the closest thing that they would have to what we call God. But he's not. Just in the name that we're using in and of itself is going to make you say, wait a minute, the void. One of the goals of Buddhism is going to be to become depersonalized and a part of the void, to cease to be a person, to cease to be an individual, to cease to have these desires, and to be a part of this great void, this great nothingness. Attractive to anyone? No? It's coming from a different culture, and that's part of our difficulty in trying to understand what's happening. The Pali Tripitaka text is considered by many to be the most reliable teaching of Buddha, although Mahayana Buddhism and other sects add to it. I'm not going to deal a lot with Buddhist scriptures. Buddhists have different versions of this Tripitaka. Most of it was written, the earliest stuff was written 400 years after Buddha's believed death. And many other sects have different items that they add on. So we're not going to spend a lot of time dealing with their individual texts. We're going to deal more with the overall philosophy of Buddhism. Next. No. I'll get there. This is my beginning of my beginning. Man suffers because of his desires are fixated on the illusion of self, which confirms him to non-permanence within the law of karma and reincarnation. So one of the goals is to cease to be within this non-permanence and to cease to be a self. Like the fact that you're a self for them is an illusion. Now, different people will talk about this different ways, but this is a grand illusion. And I'm going to bring in even certain aspects of art that I have seen in my life that I think have some Buddhist influence. I don't know for sure, but I'm getting ahead of myself. Next one, self-salvation is achieved by following the middle path. We'll get into what that is in a minute. The Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. The ultimate goal is to reach a state of nirvana where the self becomes extinguished in the void. So there are about 500 million followers worldwide. This is the fourth largest religion. There's about 500,000 followers within the United States. Here are the areas with the greatest concentration of Buddhism. As you can see, it's mostly within Asia, but then it's begun to trickle into some of the Western countries as well. Famous Buddhist. You're going to be surprised by some of these. Bill Clinton is a Buddhist. These people are either Buddhist or Buddhist sympathizers, or people that are aligning themselves with Buddhism. Next, Jerry Brown, former governor of California. Colleen Hanabusa, federal representative in Hawaii. Next, Mazie Hirayama, senator of Hawaii. Hank Johnson, representative in Georgia. Activist Rosa Parks. That was a surprise for me. She converted to Buddhism shortly before her death. Ron Reagan, Ronald Reagan's son. I believe he's the talk show host. Has a totally different politics from what his father did. Harrison Ford is a Buddhist. Orlando Bloom. Brad Pitt. Jackie Chan. There's many more that I could be naming. I'm just naming a few that I think you'll recognize. Oliver Stone, the director. Now, some musicians, Sting, David Bowie, businessman Steve Jobs was a Buddhist. Steve and Elaine Wynn, they are owners of Wynn Resorts. There's some hotels. Additionally, some athletes, Tiger Woods, Steven Seagal, and lastly, Alex Rodriguez of the New York Yankees. So there are many different people within our society that have aligned in some way with Buddhism. Siddhartha Gautama, there's a representation of him there, was from the 6th century BC. So between the years 563 and 483 BC. In a timeline, this is about the time whenever Judah was being taken away into Babylonian captivity. Halverson, within his compact book on world religions, argues that his life can be divided into three sections, enjoyment, inquiry, and enlightenment. These various categories, some of the categories aren't going to make sense coming from a Christian worldview, so there's going to be somewhat of a learning curve as we're walking through this, and it's going to sound a little complicated, but here's a first quote from a man named Jackson. I got this one out of Walter Martin's book. He says, "While frequently regarded as a new religion, it is, strictly speaking, only a reformation of Brahmanism, Hinduism, and cannot be understood without some knowledge of the conditions preceding it. The Vedas had reached in the Brahmins and the Sutras a degree of ritualism such as perhaps had never existed elsewhere. This formalism produced a revolt, and from time to time arose various teachers, philosophers, and reformers, of whom the most influential was Buddha." So we need to understand Buddhism not from a Christian worldview perspective, but rather from a Hinduism perspective. This is a cult that broke off of Hinduism, and it was very successful and became the fourth largest religion within the world. So beginning with Siddhartha's first part of his life, his first third we'll talk about, is his period of enjoyment. This will be from 563 to 534. Siddhartha Gautama was born in Nepal. At that time, Nepal was a part of India, and he was born within the warrior caste, and he grew up in a wealthy family. Now, just as a review, within Hinduism, you have these various castes. You have this highest caste, which is the... I'm not going to try to pronounce all these names because I'm going to slaughter them. But the highest caste is going to be the priestly caste and the warrior caste. Then you have this merchant, farmer caste. You have a peasant caste, peasant servant. And then you have these outcasts, these untouchables. He's in that second caste. He's in a very high place within the society. He grew up within a palace, lived a very sheltered life. That's how the story goes. He even got married. He had a son at this point, and he had lived this sheltered life within the palace, had not really gone out and seen all of the great suffering and tragedy that existed within the world. And then one day he went out just to kind of walk around the countryside for a little bit, and he was surprised. Siddhartha was surprised by suffering. He saw suffering in four areas, in age, sickness, death, and he saw sickness in these three areas, age, sickness, and death. And then lastly, he had a desire towards asceticism. So the first thing Buddha saw was an old man. Siddhartha and Buddha, I may use them interchangeably. They're the same person. He saw an old man, and he was surprised by the effects of age upon the old man. And he saw what I believe he was contemplating, the consequences of life, that everyone's going to get old. That's the way I interpret what's going on with him here, is he's lived within this very privileged life, and now he's beginning to see just, you know, the consequences of the fall upon humanity. And he's seeing that you're going to get old and you're going to die. It doesn't really matter that you're in a warrior caste. It doesn't really matter that you're wealthy and you come from this privileged family. You're going to get old someday, and you are going to die. The second thing he saw was a sick man. He saw the consequences of sickness upon people. Third thing that he saw was a dead man. So he's seeing all these aspects, the consequences of the fall, and this is really troubling him. And then he sees a fourth thing. He sees a religious man, so maybe some type of a monk or a priest, and he saw this man in this great asceticism. The man was just out there begging for money. The man didn't even have his own money. He was begging other people for money. And he had this attraction to this asceticism because he saw this man, and this man looked like a man that had joy. So he's like, well, that's what I need right there. I need to seek after this this ascetic lifestyle. And so that's what he began to do. And asceticism is to not chase after the joys of life, to not eat much. It could be to not do things that are enjoyable, just kind of the staying away from these many items within the world. He's going to stop eating for a little bit. That's going to cause him some problems in this next part of his life. Some would be in their asceticism. They would be celibate. They would get rid of earthly wealth, things like that. But he's coming from a Hindu mindset. So the Hindu mindset believes in reincarnation. So what is this all about? You live this life, you get sick, you suffer, and you die, and you come back as something else, and then you get sick, and you suffer, and you die, and you come back as something else. And he's just seeing this, and he's like, how do I break this? It's just causing him great trouble. He said, how do I break this cycle of this reincarnation? And that's kind of his desire. He wants to get out of suffering. That's the goal of Buddhism. The goal of Buddhism is to escape suffering. How do you escape suffering? You've got to get out of this non-permanence. You've got to get out of this reincarnation cycle. You've got to break yourself of break yourself of even your own personhood and individuality, and get into this great void. I always, like, when we have something like this and visitors start coming in, I'm always like, feel like I need to let them know, wait a minute. We didn't just have that happen, but it made me think about that. So his next part of his life is from 534 to 528, and that is his period of inquiry. He's disillusioned by suffering, and so he responds by living an ascetic life. And so he leaves his wife and his child. It's a very important part of Buddhism that I don't think is discussed very much. He leaves his wife and his child. He just abandons them, goes off on his own, my opinion, selfish journey. And I'm going to label a lot of this as very self-focused and selfish. So he left his wife, he left his child, he left his wealth. And so during this time, he became attracted to extreme asceticism. He sought to follow after this. He became so emaciated. He just skin and bones. He wasn't even able to really hold himself up. That one day he was bathing in a river, and he wasn't even able to hold himself up. He almost drowned, barely grabbed onto the root of a tree. And he realized, well, asceticism isn't the answer. This isn't the solution that I was looking for, because now in chasing after this, I'm just really hungry and really tired. And this isn't alleviating my suffering. This is causing me more suffering. So then you go to the third stage of his life. And this is his period of enlightenment, 528 to 483. And so what he does at this point, he walks to a nearby village at Bodh Gaya. He ate some food that someone gave him. He was emaciated, almost about to die. Someone gives him some rice milk. I guess that's some water and milk, or rice and milk, or something along that. And he sits under this tree. I don't know if it's some type of a special tree, maybe a fig tree. And he sits by the river and he vows, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to meditate until I have achieved a state of enlightenment. So he begins to meditate into a very deep state, and he sits there, and then begins to be tempted by, this is a picture of it here, this is Mara. That's the, like an evil demon or an evil one. How that's described will change from person to person, but he's being tempted in some way, and then Mara brings out his daughters to tempt him, whether they were really in front of him or they were just in his head, I don't really know. But Siddhartha withstood all of this temptation. He didn't succumb to this temptation, and then after, depending on who you talk to, either one day or either 49 days, he then reaches a state of enlightenment during this time of his when he's meditating here. It begins to rain and some vipers come out and cover him and protect him from the rain. And so the cobra is considered a very holy animal within Buddhism. And so you'll see pictures. I didn't put one up here. I meant to put one right here in my PowerPoint, but you'll see pictures of like a big Buddha statue with like viper heads going over the top of him. And so they won't kill vipers because this is a holy animal to them. Just a little bit ironic given the story that we have in Genesis 3. That's all I have to say there. But after 41 days or one day, whichever it was, he realized that the solution wasn't asceticism. The solution wasn't luxury and hedonism. The solution was this middle path, this kind of right in the middle, this moderation, seeing the dangers of both. This isn't a new idea. All right, you can see the consequences of great suffering and hedonism in the book of Ecclesiastes. You can see that within Greek philosophy. But this is something that he realized here, and he created his religion off of this. So at this point, Siddhartha now becomes a Buddha, which is an enlightened one, and he begins to travel around and give sermons. His dying words were this. He died after getting, I believe, food poisoning from maybe eating pork. That's the story that I heard. Decay is inherent in all component things. Work out your salvation with diligence. That's his last line that he says. And this all component things, this is all things that have non-permanence are going to decay and keep going through the cycle. So you've got to work out your salvation. How do you work out your salvation? By separating yourself from all of this, by separating yourself from desire, it separates yourself from suffering. And by separating yourself from that, you become non-individualized, and then you go on to be a part of the one, which is the void. This is a quote from Compact Guide on World Religions. Buddha's immediate goal was to eliminate the cause of suffering. His ultimate goal, though, was to become liberated from the cycle of death and rebirth, samsara, as this reincarnation teaching, by teaching how we can cease craving and thereby eliminate our attachment and beliefs in the existence of the illusory life. And as we are successful in eliminating such attachment, then efforts of the individual from the realm of illusion, releases the individual from the realm of illusion. At that moment of enlightenment, the person achieves a state of nirvana, the ultimate goal for the Buddhist, and the Buddhism's equivalent to salvation is to be separated from all. I do not know that this is a Buddhist quote, but it sure sounds like some of the stuff that I was studying. So I'm going to give you a quote from the rock band Styx, where he says, "Welcome to the grand illusion. Come in and see what's happening. Pay the price. Get your tickets for the show. The stage is set. The band starts playing. Suddenly the heart is pounding, wishing secretly you were a star. But don't be fooled by the radio, the TV, or the magazines. They show you photographs of how your life should be, but they're just someone else's fantasy. So if you think your life is complete confusion because you never win the game, just remember that it's a grand illusion, and deep inside, we're all the same. We're all the same. So if you think your life's complete confusion because your neighbor's got it made, just remember it's a grand illusion, and deep inside, we're all the same. We're all the same." And I believe you have this theme in there of this, you know, everything is one. We're all one. That's a belief within Buddhism. And I have this theme going here. Just hold on. I'm going to quote some Disney movies here in a little bit that I think may have some influence as well. I'm not telling you, when I give you some of these quotes, I'm not saying you can't ever listen to the song or you can't ever watch this movie, because the movie I'm going to quote, I really like that movie. It's just that a lot of Buddhism is such an interesting religion because it mixes really well with other cultures, and it mixes really well with even these so-called scientific ideas like evolution and the Big Bang theory. We're going to see how even they kind of mix really well there. And Buddha kind of took a lot of the baggage of Hinduism off of his philosophy, and it is something that kind of can go into an area and just kind of mix in there really well. So let's talk about some of the history, the splits and the spreads of Buddhism. Buddhism stayed within the border of India for 2 centuries after his death. And then King Ashoka became revolted. He was a man of bloodshed and war, but he became revolted at the sight of bloodshed and war. Here's a comic book with his picture on it. And he began to study Buddhism at that point and rejected all bloodshed at that point. And one of the tenets of Buddhism is that you're not supposed to kill any living thing. Now, that's supposed to be even like as far as an insect. If you kill a certain animal, the most that's the animal you're going to become. One of the things I don't really understand is why we don't all come back as mosquitoes. I don't know. Maybe one of them would argue that's why you have so many mosquitoes. I don't know. But that's the idea. I find it ironic, though, that Buddha died after getting food poisoning from eating pork. And I think I have an answer for that. I think I have an answer for that, and that's going to come from the Disney movie I'm going to quote in a minute. But so he became – so what King Ashoka did was he began to send out Buddhist missionaries, something that wasn't happening, as far as I know, before that time. And they began to send to Syria, Egypt, Greece, Sri Lanka, Miramar, and Thailand. Buddhism, as you know, any good cult will, is going to then go on to have its splits and its breakups, especially when, you know, the first scriptures aren't written down for 400 years. And so there's not this strong text that they're all utilizing. Even when you have a good text, things still break up. So it had its first split, and it divided over the opportunity for enlightenment. Was enlightenment something that was only possible for certain people, or whether it was enlightenment something that anyone, anywhere could go after? And so those that held that all people had an accessibility to enlightenment were called Mahayana Buddhists. And those that held that the opportunity was only for a select few were called Hinayana Buddhists. And they've then gone on to take on the name Theravada Buddhist. So the differences between them: Theravada Buddhist places a great focus upon the individual enlightenment as its highest end. So as a Theravada Buddhist, your goal is your own enlightenment, your purpose of making it on your own. Buddha is a man, and he's not a god. There's only one Buddha, and you can only attain enlightenment on your own. So it's something you've got to work out. You've got to do yourself very self-focused, very individualized. Mahayana Buddhism allows for the altruistic desire to bring others into enlightenment. So you have people that supposedly can forego nirvana for a little bit for the purpose of staying around so they can help other people get in. And they believe that Buddha was a manifestation of the universal absolute. So I guess this void came down in an incarnation as Buddha, and that's what they would understand. They believe there's also been many manifestations of the Buddha, and there's going to be at least one more. He's going to be called the Maitreya Buddha. And as I said before, they believe that certain very enlightened people, what they can do is they can help other people through their own merit, kind of like a treasury of merit idea. So these people have so much extra enlightenment, so much good karma that they've built up that they can share it with other people. Theravada Buddhism began to spread into the southeastern portions of Asia, and Mahayana Buddhism spread into the northeastern portions of Asia. And you can see a map there as it has gone around. 6th century A.D., Bodhidharma, an Indian scholar, introduced Chai Buddhism into China. And it was a technique of meditating upon the vast emptiness. And then in the 12th century, the technique of Zen Buddhism, it went over to Japan and it was kind of developed there. So wherever it goes, it kind of takes its own little flavor. It mixes in with the culture. I would say kind of like Roman Catholicism tends to do that, just not quite as rigid. Buddhism in the West, it came to America in the 19th century as Chinese began to immigrate. There's a really good documentary, at least I liked it. It's called The Search for General So, and it argues that the acceptance of Buddhism and Chinese immigration within the United States was assisted by the various restaurants that would just kind of open up in the countryside, because as Chinese restaurant owners would come over here, they wouldn't just all open them up in the same place. They'd just kind of open them up sporadically in different places, sometimes in a really small town. And so it led to a greater acceptance of this. I think they make a good argument for that. Next, you have Vajrayana Buddhism, and I'm going to give you this quote here. This is the one that you see the most of because of this guy, the Dalai Lama. And this is a quote from a professor named Chan. He says, Buddhism was introduced into Tibet about the 7th century A.D. Here is evolved into the celestial types of Buddha which appear on earth as men who are represented as on earth as the Dalai Lama, and is the type of Bodhisattva Maitreya, the future earthly Buddha and the savior of the world. So this is this recoming of this great Buddha every time that he comes. This is what the Dalai Lama thinks he is. He literally thinks he is this reincarnation of, I guess, the great void. So let's talk about some of their beliefs. They hold to what's known as the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth is a truth about truth and suffering, that life consists in suffering. They call it dukkha. And this is a concept of suffering includes experiences of pain, misery, sorrow, and unfulfillment. Here's a quote from Dr. Chan again. Existence is pain because it is irrevocably bound up in the cycle of births and death. In this connection, suffering is an undeniable fact of existence. The second noble truth has to do with the cause of suffering. Everything is impermanent and ever-changing, the doctrine of anatta. We suffer because we desire those things that are impermanent. So where they get this idea, you have to separate yourself from all desire. I do find it ironic, though, and I've said this to a Buddhist before. So you find your enlightenment and having no desire, yes? Well, do you desire that? I'm sure there's a good explanation for it, but I just find that to be a possible inconsistency. Third noble truth, having to do with cessation and suffering. The way to liberate oneself from suffering is by eliminating all desire. We must stop craving that which is impermanent. Fourthly, the fourth noble truth is the way to remove suffering. Desire can be eliminated by following the Eightfold Path, which is it just consisted of 8 points and three major sections. I want to argue that Buddha is the earliest self-help guru. I believe that is what he is. If you were to just have a thesis for Buddhism, it would be, you can do it. You can do it. You have the ability in you. You can do it. And oh, by the way, I have these strategies that you can use in accomplishing that. And that's kind of what his eightfold path is. It's this pathway where you can do this. You don't need someone else. It's about you and about you pulling up your bootstraps and about you accomplishing this and about you doing this. So what are these? We have broken up into three different categories: wisdom, which is panna; ethics and conduct, sila; and then mental discipline, which is samadhi. So wisdom is going to break down into right understanding and right thought. Under ethics, we'll have right speech, right action, right livelihood. And mental disciplines, right effort, right awareness, right meditation. There's much Buddhist influence in the Star Wars series. Here's a quote from Yoda. I think he ties in a lot of these, even within this one quote. I think this comes from the first one when he's talking to Anakin Skywalker as a young child. He says, "Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering." So let's walk through his first point here of wisdom. This is from Compact Guide to World Religions. Right thought follows right understanding. In that, it means to renounce all attachment to desires and thoughts of illusory selves. Okay? Jedi Code. There is no emotion. There is peace. There is no ignorance. There is knowledge. There is no passion. There is serenity. There is no chaos. There is harmony. There is no death. There is force. Very much in line with these Buddhist ideas that you are separating yourself from these emotions, ignorance, passions, all of this towards the higher way of thought. Compact Guide of World Religions. As persons attain such literal selfless perspective, he or she finds the power to speak well of others, to have right speech, to obey Buddhism's moral commands and abstentions, right action, and to avoid making his or her living through an occupation that breaks the moral precepts of Buddhism, which is a right livelihood. So some of their moral prohibitions is the taking of life, all forms, not just human. They're going to need some caveats on that, I'm sure. But there are different levels to which people will go in this. You have some that go so far as to, you know, not even touch an ant, and others not as much that way. Next is stealing. Immoral sexual behavior. The monks must be celibate. But that said, it's kind of a live and let live viewpoint here. Doesn't force marriage. If you're going to be married, you need to be faithful, you know. But as far as these other mores that we would have, there really aren't a bunch of mores in that area. Just be nice to people. Don't hurt people. That's the rules you have in that area. Now, fourth is lying, and fifth is taking of intoxicants, or overly taking intoxicants. And all of these things are not for the purpose of, in doing this, I'm sinning against the holy God. Not doing these things is about, in doing these things, it's tying me to that which is impermanent. It's tying me to that. My desire to steal, I'm tied to that which is impermanent. And so all of these things that we have here, it's really just about not being tied to that which is that is impermanent. Next quote: deep states of consciousness in which all sense of personal identity ceases, through which right effort, one prevents evil thoughts from entering the mind. Through right awareness, one is especially conscious of the events of one's life. And through right meditation, one can attain the bliss of enlightenment. And here's a quote from Buddha. There is a sphere which is neither earth, nor water, nor fire, nor air, which is not a sphere of infinity of space, nor a sphere of infinity of consciousness, the sphere of nothingness, the sphere of perception or non-perception, which is neither this world, neither sun nor moon. I deny that it is coming or going, enduring death or birth. It is only the end of suffering. really squishy, right? Really, really squishy talk. A quote from Walter Martin. We become lost in a maze of terminology when God is reduced to an unknowable essence. What do we mean when we talk about God? Can we talk about God as a subject and object relationship? Do we talk about God as I and thou? No. These religions do not talk about God in this way. They do not talk about God as a person. They sometimes use personal terms, but God is not a person. They behold God when they behold themselves, because all creation shares in their understanding of God. Reality to them is grounded in us as human beings. Last quote here on nirvana. Nirvana does not mean that a person is annihilated when entering such a state, because as Buddha reasoned, there never existed any person to be annihilated in the first place. So what is another place I think I see some of this thought is in Lion King. Mufasa and Simba are sitting there. Mufasa says, everything you see exists together in a delicate balance. As king, you need to understand that balance and respect of all creatures, from the crawling ant to the leaping antelope. But Dad, don't we eat the antelope? Yes, Simba, but let me explain. We die and our bodies become the grass and the antelope eat the grass. And so we are all connected in this great circle of life. It's my thought on how Buddha justified eating pork. I don't really know for sure how he did it, but the circle of life idea. So ultimately, Buddhism's goal is about eliminating suffering. That's the whole purpose of the religion, is how we can end and alleviate suffering and no longer experience suffering. He realized the key to no longer experiencing suffering was to no longer have desire. My opinion is that Buddhism is a very self-focused religion. I believe we could even call it a selfish religion. And I think a lot of people that practice the religion would be shocked for me to say that, because they like to give this idea that it's all about not you. But the whole reason why you're doing everything that you're doing is for this very selfish motive, not to make right what you did that was wrong, just to eliminate suffering for your own self. Where is it in Buddha's life that he ever went back and made right with his wife and his child that he abandoned? Why did he not find it necessary to do that? Because that's not a part of his religion. His religion was a self-focused religion that was about him achieving that which he desired, about him no longer having any suffering. I think that's a part that's not often brought out about Buddhism, but in my study of it, that's my takeaway at this point. He was right. To be human is to suffer. We talked about that when I preached through Psalm 6 a couple weeks ago. We talked about that. To be human is to suffer. Someone who realizes that suffering is a part of being human is correct. It is a part of being human within this fallen state. See, but the problem is that he had the wrong solution for the problem, and he had the wrong diagnosis of the problem. Right? To be human is to suffer, not because we are not in a state of permanence, but rather because we are under a curse because of sin. Sin is our main problem. And sin is something that Buddhism is not going to be able to solve. Yes, Buddhism can help you with certain behavior. I am certain that some of the people that we mentioned at the beginning are assisted in their businesses and their habits through Buddhism. When I did prison ministry before, it wasn't a part of this ministry, but whenever you are going to do prison ministry, you have to go through a certain training class with the state just to tell you, these are your guidelines, this is what you have, the parameters you have to work in. And right next to me was a Buddhist, and he was going to, I don't know what he was going to do, he was going to run some kind of a Buddhist class, but he was right there next to me. And so I believe that Buddhism can help you with certain behaviors. I believe that you can grab a self-help book and it can help you with certain behaviors, but it doesn't help you with your main problem. It's not going to help you to deal with the main problem that you have within you, and that is your sin. So how do we talk to a Buddhist? This is not going to be a series of just give them this Bible verse and then give them that and give them this Bible verse. If you have an opportunity to share the gospel with a Buddhist, most likely it's going to be a series of conversations. One of the first times that I saw the shortcomings of that, the little tract that's put out by Campus Crusade for Christ called The Four Spiritual Laws, is when I was talking to a Buddhist, and I realized, like, I couldn't even get past, like, law one. And then law two, now we're talking about sin. And they don't have categories that we have within Christianity. And that little tract, by the way, was made not for talking to a Buddhist, but for talking to college students that had basically backslidden when they went to college and had kind of grown up in church. So they already knew a lot of this stuff. So you could have this conversation with them in about 5 to 15 minutes and then go on to the next person. When you have someone that's coming from this kind of a background, especially if they come from a society and a culture that is seeped in this, it's not just something that is solved just with a few just quick conversations. It's going to be something that's going to happen gradually over time. And not saying that the Holy Spirit's not working. I'm just telling you that my experience in talking to people, that you begin to just throw these ideas out, and there has to be a conversation that begins to happen. And remember, this is a cult that broke off of another religion. It broke off of Hinduism. So there's a lot of work that's got to be done here to rebuild this foundation that just doesn't exist. All right, you have humanity and you have the law. And so you do have that you can deal with. And that is a foundation that exists with everyone everywhere. Everyone knows that they've broken the law of God. And Buddhism tries to solve that issue in ways that don't even come close to analyzing the problem. So approach. This is what I would recommend. I would recommend that if you're talking to someone, don't try to fix every error that they have at the same time. All right. Find a place to begin barraging someone with every single possible point of difference is not going to be a great strategy. If you'll pay attention to some of the conversations that Jesus has with the Jewish leaders, you will see that. I hope you do. When you're reading this, you'll see them say something, and there's many different ways that he could have responded to them. And he usually just responds in a particular way. And it's not even always the same way. I think what we can get from that is, like, you need to have something that you're saying. I'm not saying you can only say one thing. Don't walk away with that. But what I am saying is don't pick 50 things. Because, I mean, the person is a human, and you're giving them something that they're not even accustomed to, that they're not used to. And so you need to have some patience there. And it takes patience on your part. Because what do you want to do? I just want to get through my yellow track and get to the end, and there's a prayer at the end, and then I'll go on to the next person. It may not be that way, especially if you have someone that's willing to listen to you. And in these conversations, sometimes you'll find some faults in even your own reasoning or your own, philosophy or the way that you're thinking. You'll find areas where, I never really thought of it that way, and I'm not really taking the best approach there. Even if someone converts, and that's what I want to make that point too. Even if someone converts from Buddhism to Christianity, don't be surprised if it doesn't take years to strip off all of the baggage that exists there, especially if they were seeped into it, especially if they grew up within that culture. And I want to warn you here, that is not generally done by sitting down with the person and telling them everything that is wrong with them. I want you to think about your own life. How many times has your life been fixed because someone just sat down right next to you and about 10 minutes told you everything that you were doing wrong and why it was wrong? And then got up and walked away. Probably not. Yeah, the Holy Spirit can work that way, but generally it's progressive sanctification. And it's progressive sanctification from the place where you are. And so when you have someone that's coming out of a system like this, they may be way over here, and they're going to look different as they're walking through this. The main things that you need to talk about, if you're going to talk about with them, it's going to be basic Christianity. This is not just, here's a verse, go give them this verse. And here's this verse, go give them this verse. Like you're just gonna bring them that one verse and they're going to not be a Buddhist anymore. You need to have an understanding of the doctrine of God. God is not an impersonal void. Instead, he is... That's driving me crazy. I can't keep that. God is not an impersonal void. Instead, He is a personal God. And he is a spirit. So to understand these ideas, they need to understand who God is. That's our foundation of our understanding of Christianity. Next, you need to have a doctrine of man. All right, man is not eternal. Man is sinful. There's many places in Scripture you can see this. Psalm 139:13. For I formed your inward parts; you were knitted together. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. Genesis 1:26. God said, "Let us make man in our image." That's important there too, because it makes man distinct from every other creature within the world. I think we know through basic reason that an ant is not the same as a human. And I think even just with basic logic, you can have that conversation with someone and say, you know this isn't the same because you in your life don't treat them the same. I mean, how far are we going to take this down? Do like the, even the amoebas, do they have, are they being reincarnated too? And as you're walking around and stepping on them, are they going back into the cycle? Man is sinned. Man is sinful. That's another key doctrine that needs to be covered. All sin and fall short of the glory of God. The wages of sin is death, but the free gift of God is eternal life in Jesus Christ our Lord. There must be an understanding of sin. But you've got to understand who God is. You've got to understand the nature of man and how man was originally made. Then you need to go to sin. So what am I telling you to talk? I'm telling you to talk to them about the gospel. But you need to have a thorough understanding of this yourself. The necessity of an atonement is the next topic you need to talk about. Romans 3:9-12. As it is written, none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one. So there is a necessity for a Savior because of the sin that man committed. And that salvation comes through Christ alone. Acts 4:12. And there is salvation in no one else. For there is no other name under heaven given among men which we must be saved. Again, Jesus Christ says, John 14:6-7. I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, you would have known my Father. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. And so some Buddhists will think, well, there's many different ways. Okay, you have your way, I have mine. You need to emphasize, no, it's not. Okay, it's Jesus or nothing. You can't have it. Jesus doesn't give you that option. There's plenty of scriptures that you can read. Jesus was not inclusive of all other religions. He was not inclusive of all other viewpoints. He was exclusive. It's not a popular view. But many of the people that want to say they're inclusive, they're exclusive of anyone who's not so-called inclusive. So they end up not even being inclusive themselves. So no, Buddhism's not the same as Christianity. You cannot have Jesus and this other philosophy, and you can't have both and. It's not an option. And that emphasis needs to be laid down. And so that they can understand that you can't have both, because what you don't want is for someone to, you know, okay, I'll accept what you say, I'll go along with what you say, and then they're just putting Jesus on the shelf next to their other idols, and that's not biblical Christianity. It's a false convert.